You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 6th of September 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. We are not actually live today, but we do have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II, producer extraordinaire, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how are you doing today? How are you, sir?
I'm okay. What can I say? I'm surviving. Could be the word.
Survivors. We are all survivors of the political correctness purge. You're surviving on BitChute at the moment, aren't you, Dennis? Is that correct?
Yeah, I've been on this week, actually, for... I know it's been going really well, BitChute. It's just that not a lot of people know about it, and I don't think YouTube's ever going to, you know, be a platform to promote it.
Yeah, we need to do what we can to get BitChute out there as an alternative, I think. They do seem to be holding up as far as free speech is concerned. YouTube are going absolutely purge crazy. I mean, they're just removing channels that haven't even been flagged. They haven't had any warnings, and they're just being
pulled. I think another reason at all, really. I don't know if you've noticed, most TVs now have an automatic line straight to YouTube, which means a lot of mainstream now is going to be going to YouTube just automatically. And I don't think they want any of our material. In fact, I found an old channel of mine last night, gave the password, and it still refused me entrance.
Yeah, I thought this for a while. When the BBC started saying, and you can reach us on Facebook and you can reach us on Twitter, and I thought, yeah, you know, this is the reason why they come down more heavy on nationalists that are on those two sites, because they're being advertised by the BBC. And if people then go on there and they see the nationalist stuff, it's like when you see those adverts on nationalist YouTube channels and they say, well, we don't want our adverts to be appearing on those same channels. So there's, what is the word for
their agenda, yeah, really, isn't it?
Guilt by association. Oh. finally.
Well, guilt by association. Guilt by association when it's just being a nationalist, I ask you.
That's what they're talking about. But of course, guilt by association, I mean, that was used to execute people at Nuremberg. And yeah, we're going to be talking, this is the third part of our series, actually, upon quotes from the accused at Nuremberg, the kangaroo court that was used to basically execute revenge, Jews executing revenge upon...
Officially.
Officially against the people that they just crushed in war, basically. I mean, that unconditional surrender, that had never been heard of before. Unconditional
surrender. That was Roosevelt, that, wasn't it, all the way for that.
Yeah, but when you think about it, that's what they were defending against. So, you know, what are they supposed to just not give up their lives, you know, fighting to defend their country from unconditional surrender, from the enemy being able to just go in and do whatever it wanted? They're supposed to just roll over and allow that to happen. And if they don't, it's crimes against peace.
You've got to remember, like I said, this is the most evil, vicious, ruthless empire that's ever been.
I think you're right, Dennis. I think you are right there. Well, let's get into the first of these quotes. Comes from Admiral Dönitz. Dönitz was named Hitler's successor as head of state, with the title of President of Germany and Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces. Dönitz was indicted as a major war criminal at the Nuremberg trials on three counts: conspiracy to commit crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, planning, initiating, and waging wars of aggression, and crimes against the laws of war. He was found not guilty on count one of the indictment, but guilty on counts two and three. He was sentenced to 10 years imprisonment. After his release, he lived in a village near Hamburg until his death in 1980. For nearly seven decades, Dönitz was the only head of state to be convicted by an international tribunal, until the conviction of Liberia's Charles Taylor in April 2012. So they used the Nuremberg trials as a precedent so that they could then take other heads of state to court, which is what they did with Liberia. And wasn't it Admiral Dönitz that surrendered? Am I right in thinking that, because he was the head of state?
Yeah, he was a man of integrity, and a lot of the British knew that and tried to make sure that he got a fair trial, from what I remember. But to say he was a major war criminal was scandalous, because he did everything by the book. He fought war as war, you know, can be fought with certain morals. And certainly, you know, for him, I think he ended up getting about 10 years, which really was a travesty.
Well, and you think he was the guy that actually surrendered, and, you know, and then they're going to prosecute him and say that he was a war criminal. Well, the quote that he says, Admiral Nimitz has said that he conducted unrestricted warfare in the whole Pacific Ocean from the first day after Pearl Harbor. And that must be in reference to the accusation that the National Socialists conducted unrestricted warfare. So what he's pointing out is that the Americans have admitted that they carried out unrestricted warfare. So why is he being charged with it? Do you know what that term, what the definition of that term is, Dennis, this unrestricted warfare? What does it mean?
Well, it sounds like it's just what the Americans did, really, where they didn't have no prisoners of war camps down in the Pacific. They just, you know, prisoners were caught, prisoners were killed, just a complete all-out war. But whether that's really what that means, I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, we had that accusation last week, didn't we, about them executing prisoners, this order that said that if people were going to be a threat, partisans, that is, if terrorists were going to be a threat to their operations, then they should be executed. And what you've got here is unrestricted warfare going on in the Pacific. I think that was to do with the submarines as well, where they were supposed to rescue people, weren't they, if they went into the drink. And right. I think what they're saying here is the Germans weren't doing that when they were, but in actual fact, it was the Americans that weren't doing that. Well, what was that bit in The Greatest Story Never Told, Dennis, with the sharks? That's to do with...
Yeah, that was that. In Indianapolis, which took over parts of the atomic bomb, apparently. And on its return, it kind of was instant karma when the ship was sunk, and a lot of the prisoners were thrown into the water. I think about 900 altogether was thrown into the water. A good 600, I believe, perished. Not all by sharks, but a terrifying 48, 72 hours in the waters with sharks circling and obviously taking a chunk every now and again.
And I think, didn't you put that bit in there because you'd got a bit fed up of all the
podcast.
That's what you were concentrating at the time, was it? The gas chambers. You needed a break.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's heavy duty, you know what I mean? Like, and I just needed to clear my head. So I thought that was certainly for the British audience, and they didn't know a lot about it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it does break the documentary up a bit. A little bit of Jaws action. The next character we've got here, General Alfred Jodl, the German general who served as the chief of operations staff of the Armed Forces High Command. And the principal charges against him related to his signature of the Commando and Commissar orders. Found guilty on all charges, he was sentenced to death and executed in Nuremberg in 1946. Actually, I think that was the orders that I was referring to just then, actually. And the commando order, and that was stating that in retaliation for their opponents employing in their conduct of the war methods which contravene the International Convention of Geneva. So this is people that have broken the International Convention of Geneva. The Germans were instructed not only to tie the prisoners up, but also to kill captives who they think might prove an encumbrance to them or hinder them in successfully carrying out their aims. Which is just logical, really. It's just saying that, look, if you've got terrorists that you think are likely to sabotage your actions, then you have to find some way of preventing them from doing that. If they're not going to be good prisoners and accept the fact that they have been taken prisoner, then logically, you know, you can kill them. You can execute them. I mean, they've already broken, on their side, they've already contravened all the international treaties. They're not fighting in uniform. They're fighting in, you know, in plain clothes, or even fighting in German uniform. That's what it means.
The funny thing is that the Americans never adhered to the Geneva Conventions anyway. They stripped all the prisoner of wars. They were enemy combatants.
Unbelievable. Yeah, that's what they did afterwards, wasn't it, when they put them in the camps, all the Germans in the camps. And the Commissar order, it instructed the Wehrmacht that any Soviet political commissar identified among captured troops should be summarily executed as a purported enforcer of Judeo-Bolshevism in the military forces. So what does that mean? Well, it wasn't the Soviets, weren't they shooting at the people at the front or something like that at one point? Wasn't that one of Stalin's directives, Dennis?
Well, to be honest, the commissars were a target for the Germans when they went in, because these are the ones that controlled the towns and villages and were the most hated. And even the occupants of the villages turned on the commissars even before the German army got there, when they were on the way. So these are people who were they had an ideology that you could never change their mind. And so Hitler just thought you just take them out. Otherwise, you know, you're just banging your head against the wall. Die-hard communists. And so that particular part, you know, is true. Whether that's a war crime or not is another thing altogether.
So they were guilty of carrying out a reign of terror against the peasants and the villagers. And this was a just punishment for them. Basically.
Well, they probably committed murder themselves, you know what I mean?
Well, obviously, if they were commissars.
Yeah. That's right.
And also, I think, you know, they would have been mistreating the people that were in the military anyway. Didn't Stalin have... didn't he say to them that he was going to start executing their family members if any of them were taken prisoner?
Yeah, it's quite a character, Stalin. Yeah, if a prisoner of war was caught, then you got to remember Stalin didn't believe in any prisoner of the wars, not even his son. When he tried to exchange prisoners with his son, he denied having a son. So any prisoner of war, at the end of the war, when the camps were liberated, they may have been cheering, but they didn't know that the Russians were then going to put them under a questionnaire in a building somewhere, and eventually, if they'd have been found to be, what's the word I'm looking for, stained, maybe, by the Germans, you know, this happened in the Soviet Union itself. All the areas what the Germans occupied, they'd been stained by the Germans. They were all shipped to Siberia or wiped out. Well, the same with the prisoners, and they were sent to the gulags. Now, what you're talking about, I think, as well, is that if any prisoners were caught as prisoners of war, the families were also sent to the gulags. So when they got to the gulags, they probably met their mum and dad or whatever. That's how crazy that were.
And didn't they have people at the back there, and they were there to not to shoot at the enemy, but to shoot at the Red Army if they weren't fighting hard enough?
Or... And actually showed footage of that on The Greatest Story Never Told, which was rare, very rare footage, where they were there with a machine gun behind the troops waiting for anyone who... Well, Stalin's order was not one step back. So anybody looking like they were going to, or even turning and running away, were immediately mauled down.
And that would have been the commissars that would have been responsible for that.
Yeah, yeah, these die-hard communists, yeah.
So again, that, you know, that's probably what it means by an enforcer of Judeo-Bolshevism in the military forces.
And that's exactly what it means, yeah.
Yeah. Well, these are the quotes that we have from Alfred Jodl. He says, "Hitler talked to me in July 1940 about the possible hostilities with Russia. He wanted to be ready to forestall an attack by Russia in the autumn. Hitler was convinced that Russia would squeeze or attack us in the near future and that England would encourage it." And of course, that was found to be entirely correct.
I can go into detail on this one.
Go on.
The northeast of Europe had already seen probing by the Soviets. Finland was doing a battle with them, and Romania, they had problems with them. So all this part of Europe was, I mean, Latvia and Estonia had already gone under the communists. So, you know, that you could tell what was happening. There was simply moving west. And so what the problem was, at the end of the day, he had a meeting with Molotov. And this is where Hitler began to get suspicious, because Molotov came with three requests, if I can remember. Okay, yeah, so he had three reasons, well, three offers from Molotov. One was that he was asking Germany not to intervene in the Finnish war, because he said that the Soviet Union, Finland was a threat to the existence of the Soviet Union, which Hitler kind of smiles and said, no, I can't agree to that. They then asked him if there'd be no German intervention in Romania. And he'd already had done a deal with the leader of Romania. And again, I've got to stay true to my word. I can't give you that guarantee. And then there was a third one, which actually doesn't come to mind at the moment. But anyway, Hitler didn't agree to it. And he knew from that moment, he could see the plans, what the Soviet Union were planning. And he also sensed to get ready for war, because he didn't want to go down in history as someone who thought it might happen, but didn't really want it to happen, so didn't act. He thought, I'm the leader of the Germans. I've got this understanding now that, you know, the Russians are going to attack. So I've got to make plans to combat it. Being a positive move.
And weren't the Soviet troops all arranged in battle formation as well, rather than defensive? And that's, you know, why they were caught in the hop.
Yeah, in East Prussia at that time, I think the Germans had three divisions. Were already on the border of East Prussia with 22 divisions by the Russians. And so, obviously, he's reinforced that area, and he's got people keeping an eye on him, because, obviously, he's wary of an attack. And when the attack finally did come, it was 2 weeks before Stalin was due, hidden from Western history books, as we mentioned before. And when he did attack, he annihilated the Soviets on the border, simply because they were in defensive formation. They were ready to attack with attack mode weapons. And so they're taken completely by surprise. And Hitler actually said that he praised the European Union for coming together. You know, the countries, I think off the top of my head, it was Finland, Romania, Croatia, Bulgaria, Spanish volunteers, and Germany and Italy had all come together secretly, because if word had got out, like he said, it would never change Stalin's mind, but they would have lost the element of surprise. And without that element of surprise, they could have lost a lot of men.
And you also got like the huge build-up of tanks. The largest, yes. largest manufacturer of tanks that had ever been known. I can remember that footage you've got with them all on these train tracks.
And of course, the tracks were simply removable, so that, you know, the wheels beneath them could run on the motorway system, which Germany had. And obviously, there's no such motorway tracks or roads in Russia. So the only reason they had these wheels were because of the attack on Germany.
And then you got the archives, the information that was in the archives that was released in the 90s when the Soviet Union fell. It also confirmed that Stalin was planning this invasion. So it was a preemptive strike. So
as did Lenin Brezhnev, the president, he also announced, you know, during the 70s that it was true Stalin was going to attack. And he should know.
So it's all entirely true and proper, what Alfred Jodl is saying here. And then he says, to the accusation on the bombing of Rotterdam, I reply that the losses were not as heavy as from the bombing of Leipzig after the Allies knew that they had won the war. The attack on Russia was based on the opinion of the politicians that the non-aggression pact was not being observed by Russia. So again, you got confirmation there of what you were just saying, Dennis, about them going into Finland and Romania. And then you got talking about how the bombing had continued even after the Allies had won the war. There was still, they did more damage to Leipzig than the accusation of the German bombing of Rotterdam.
That's right. That's after the war.
Was that after Donitz had actually surrendered? They continued bombing?
I would imagine so, because Donitz weren't in charge for that long.
Right. And then he also says, now they want to hide the fact that there was a secret treaty with Russia. They cannot do it. I had the advanced demarcation line right among my plans and planned the campaign accordingly. So there was a secret treaty between Britain and Russia. Is that what he's saying there?
It doesn't surprise me, because obviously I've always said all along that the US banks had funded the revolution via London. And so, you know, the Soviet Union really was there. If they're going to play a good cop, bad cop situation, then the Soviet Union were the bad cop.
They certainly were on the side of the Soviets, weren't they? I mean, you can see that from after the war, when they just handed Poland over to them, when apparently the war was started because of the invasion of Poland. There was no invasion of Russia.
Churchill apparently just signed it on a piece of paper. Well, you don't usually do things like that. Things are more official. But I think because they'd won the war, Russia was always in the pocket. What throws everything in the air is the fact that Stalin changed at some point, where he learned about some stuff from the train he took back to Moscow from Germany, full of Freemason documents and memorabilia. And I honestly believe he wasn't meant to see any of that at any time. And if he has found something in a train load, which is not beyond imagination, then he would have seen that the Freemasons are not against invading countries who were already Freemasons, such as South Africa and such as Libya, as I talked about. At the end of the day, you know, there's no loyalty as such. Throughout history, the Freemasons have fought for the Freemasons.
And once Soviets had taken control of Russia, they had no need for the Freemasons anymore, because they had control of it.
Yeah, and plus he purged the Jews then, whereas in the beginning he never purged any Jews. In fact, he brought out the anti-Semitic laws with the death sentence, and he only purged the Freemasons at that time who weren't Jews. So real, you know, evidence of him turning. And then the fact that I found out that in 1950 the US actually bombed bases of the Soviet Union, which not a lot of people knew about, probably because they were getting a bit pissed with him, not doing as he was told. Obviously, he's took half of Europe with him, so they've lost all that usury and all that usual stuff that they get from taking over countries. And people, I don't know, they just don't understand that with Stalin turning after he was murdered, which they believed he was poisoned, then the Soviet Union was back in the banker's hands. And just as an example, people will say for instance, about, you know, when the Americans landed on the moon, if they didn't land on the moon, why didn't the Russians say so? Well, by that time, the Russians were back in under the banks anyway, so they wouldn't have said anything. But that's going off subject, but that's just an example.
So Stalin went off the reservation a bit there. Yeah, absolute hypocrisy is what's going on there. The next one that we've got here is Joachim von Ribbentrop, the foreign minister from 1938 until 1945. Again, he was also executed. Got some good quotes from him here. He says, "A few years from now, the lawyers of the world will condemn this trial. You cannot have a trial without law." So what does he mean there? Well, he means that under whose authority is this trial taking place? You have to have an authority. You know, in Britain, it's always the crown that prosecutes somebody, because the crown is at the top, and you can't actually take the crown to court, because the crown is the authority. You can't actually take the Queen to court. She can't break any laws because she's the one that, that keeps the law. And in the same way, in Germany, you can't take the administration to trial in Germany because they are the authority. And nobody else, anywhere else in the world, has authority over what is done within Germany. And all the Germans were doing were defending themselves. So there was no law. It made a mockery of the law, and it set a precedent since then that they continue to use.
Well, the thing is, Ribbentrop was the guy who pleaded at the the League of Nations about the atrocities with the in Poland with the German minorities. And so he wasn't particularly a person that would have escaped any punishment, I don't think. But yeah, for sure. I think the guy was a stand-up guy and, like most of them, you know, did everything by the rule book, as proven in the White Book when we did the episode.
Well, I think that's what he's saying, isn't it? What rule book are you guys following by putting us on trial? There is no
first time it's ever been done. Yeah,
yeah. That you cannot have a trial without law. The next quote he says: "Of course, I was one of his most faithful followers. The Führer had a terrifically magnetic personality. You can't understand it unless you've experienced it. 6 months after his death, I still feel it. Everybody was fascinated by him. Even if great intellects came together for a discussion, why, in a few minutes, they just ceased to exist." And the brilliance of Hitler's personality shone over all. Why, even at the discussions on the Munich Pact, Daladier and Chamberlain were simply overwhelmed by his charm. You got an interesting bit of insight there as to the relationship between Hitler and Chamberlain before the war. I mean, people try to say today that Chamberlain was some kind of an appeaser, and he was just trying to avoid war. And he obviously could see that Hitler was as it says here, a brilliant personality, an intellectual, a great intellect that was magnetized.
It was Hitler called the Munich peace meeting. You know, people think Hitler was looking for war, but he was the one who called it so that, you know, they could sort out the problem in Czechoslovakia.
So, Hitler trying to avoid war, not trying to start a war, and he continues with it. He says, "Can't you feel the terrific strength of Hitler's personality? Can't you see how he swept people off their feet?" And I guess they sort of tried to make a meal out of this, didn't they? And they tried to say that he brainwashed the German people.
Hypnotized or brainwashed.
Yeah. When really it was just that he did such great things for the German people, you know, they genuinely loved him. You know, I can remember seeing the pictures of Gaddafi and the Libyan people, and they were all holding up these pictures of Gaddafi. And they were trying to portray that as these people are brainwashed and they're being forced to hold these pictures up. But, you know, people can't be brainwashed into doing that. You could see him driving along in his car with all these Libyans running after him. And you could see that he was a leader that was well-loved by his people because he'd done a good job of leading them. And you had the same thing with Adolf Hitler, who was a good leader. He did a fantastic job of raising the Germans up from the pits that they were in after the Versailles Treaty.
And they were grateful. Pits.
Yeah, and they were grateful to him for it. And that's why they continued to fight that war right through till the bitter end. You know, the British thought if we bomb the hell out of the civilian houses, they'll soon lose, you know, they'll lose their courage and they'll lose their desire to fight back. And it had the opposite effect because they supported Hitler right through until the very end, right through until it was just the little children and the old men that were left fighting.
And yeah, they still ordinary fought. People never turned against him. Obviously, he had the one or two officers who tried to assassinate him, and in doing so, assassinated their own friends. But other than that, then, you know, the ordinary people of Germany had total faith in him.
Yeah, he tried to sabotage their own country's war effort. You don't get more.
Yeah.
Treacherous than that. No. He says, "The last time I saw Hitler was on April the 23rd, 1945. I felt sure then that Hitler intended to remain in Berlin until the end. I was able to ask him what he wanted me to do if it came to the point of surrender. He said, I should try to remain on good terms with Britain. He always wanted that, you know? Mm-hmm. He did. I mean, he says that in Mein Kampf, doesn't he? He feels the strongest kinship with the British people, and he just wanted to get on with England as brother nations.
Yeah.
And in the end, it was his undoing, really, because when he had the Britons at France, and he could have taken them captive, or he could have shot them. I mean, he had won, basically. He'd taken over France, and he, like a gentleman, he just let the British army be picked up and taken back to Britain, and thought that Churchill would again behave like a gentleman, and rather than continue a war where loads more people are going to die, admit that, you know, he had lost, basically. I mean, that's what you do when you have your enemy at the point of the sword and your enemy owes you for his life. The enemy doesn't suddenly get up and then stab the guy in the back after he's just had mercy on you and given you his life, because the choice then is either accept slavery or accept death. And the person who is the victor, he's just given you his life. Hitler gave life to all those soldiers that could have been captives that were on the beach there, and he didn't. He was magnanimous. He was merciful in victory. He gave them life, and Churchill turned around, stabbed him in the back, and continued to prosecute the war. And that was due to Hitler thinking so highly of the British people. Disgusting.
Also due to Jewish mentality running Britain as well, which has no morals in war, as we've already found out on several occasions.
And Churchill wasn't properly British, was he? His mother was Red Indian squaw. Yeah, his mother was a Red Indian squaw. He was some mongrelized type of human being. I had no loyalty to laws of chivalry or gentlemanliness.
I have to say there has been research to say that it wasn't just a case of Hitler letting them go. I mean, you know, some people have researched that actually the tanks, the weather was that bad, the tanks, if they'd have moved towards the beaches, would have been bogged down. But again, that's, you know, it's just researched whether it's true or not, you know. It's hard to say. That's why I actually put that in the greatest story never told, that some people looked on it as a monumental mistake and others looked on it as a magnanimous attempt, you know, to keep peace.
Yeah, I mean, the symbolism of that, you know, there's great symbolism in that, isn't there, that he was merciful in victory. Mm. That's what it was. The logistics of trying to take everybody prisoner would have been awkward, and the logistics of killing them all, you know, which he would have been at the right to do, both of those, but he didn't. He was merciful in victory, and in return, Churchill stabbed him and the rest of Europe in the back and didn't behave like a gentleman.
They probably never mentioned that in the Nuremberg trials either. It never probably came into it, did it?
No, I can't recall that was ever mentioned there. He also says that Joachim von Ribbentrop, he says, I was always for a rapprochement with Russia. Hitler thought we would be attacked sooner or later. History will show that Hitler was right and I was wrong. So again, that's good of him to admit that he thought, you know, they could make peace with Russia, and Hitler knew that that wouldn't be possible and that Stalin would attack sooner or later. Hitler was proved to be right. He also said, we wanted a peaceful solution, a counterbalance to England's balance of power politics. They were constantly oppressing us. Just imagine going to war over Danzig, such a world catastrophe, just to prevent Germany from getting a piece of territory that belonged to her, because Britain was afraid Germany was getting too strong.
That's quite true.
Yeah, that gets to the heart of it, doesn't it? Because that's what it was all about. It was just Germany going to war because the Germans were being persecuted in Danzig in Poland, and they were not allowed to have a railway to get to them so that they could get food to them and supplies and trade with them and everything else. The Poles refused it and instead thought that they could provoke Germany into a war, and then Britain would ally with the Poles and the Poles would stand to gain German territory. That was what happened.
Yeah, and the person behind it all, as we found out in one of the episodes, was Roosevelt.
Yeah, Roosevelt was encouraging that as well. And obviously the the capitalists, the Jewish bankers. He also said, I always approved a cooperation between Germany and Russia. England could have prevented the war by merely saying one word. If they had just told the Poles to make peace, the whole war would have been avoided. But Britain was playing her balance of power policy in Europe. Our demands were so reasonable, it was not necessary to go to war about it. Again, that was the point of it. Britain was encouraging the Germans to encouraging the Poles to get the Germans to make war, and then the British would come in on the side of the Poles. Germany wanted to make peace.
Obviously, France were getting treats from America to also stand by Britain.
He says, do you know what I planned? I wanted to include the Russians in our three-power pact and make it a four-power pact between Germany, Italy, Japan and Russia. I wanted a free hand to deal with England for all emergencies. So again, I mean, he was wrong in what he thought about Russia, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, like I said, the proof of this is the Spanish Revolution when the American bankers were funding through the Soviet Union. There's evidence of that. So after the Soviet Union fell, after the Russian Revolution, the Bolsheviks took over. They were funded by the bankers, which means the bankers put in charge and give the orders.
He says, we Germans are a peculiar people. We are so loyal. People don't seem to understand that. Loyalty, my word.
Yes, honour and loyalty means a lot to them.
A big part of the SS. They were loyal to Hitler and loyal to the Germans that were in Poland. I think maybe he's referring to that as well. They were loyal to the Germans that were being persecuted by the Poles, and they couldn't.
Well,
stand
it wasn't
by
just the Germans either. I mean, there was other minorities down there also getting persecuted, but they didn't have the stature of Germany behind them. You know, there was other minorities like Ukrainians, but they didn't really have an army to threaten Poland.
Right, I was just going to ask which minorities they were.
Yeah.
He says, we could have solved the Jewish problem peacefully with a quota system, or by transporting them to the east or to Madagascar. And that's what the plan was. They just didn't want this foreign group that obviously were just trying to get what they could out of Germany. They weren't contributing to Germany. They were buying everything up and encouraging depravity, sexual depravity, and they didn't want them doing that, basically. You know, what's wrong with that? If you've got a foreign group that's within your country that's acting like a fifth column, that's taking over the government and influencing the government and influencing your culture, it's quite normal to wish to rid yourself of them, and like it says here, with a quota system, or by transporting them to the east. You know, there's no idea of gassing them or anything like that. But the Jews' response to that was to then rile up the rest of the world and get the rest of the world to go to war against Germany, which kind of proves that the Germans were right.
Well, it goes back to even Untermeyer's speech, where he's, you know, they're demanding, before he declared war, they demanded that the Germans get rid of Hitler and reinstate every single Jew and communist who they'd got rid of. And the Germans are simply turning around and saying, who are you to tell us Germans what to do in our own country?
It's kind of like America today telling Venezuela what to do, or telling Hong Kong what to do. It's this same attitude, that's where it comes from. He says, Germany did not break the Munich Pact. We made the mistake of losing the war. Incidentally, America has used its army to suppress opposition by force 150 times in the past 150 years. What do you think he's referring to there, Dennis?
Well, I mean, America's practically fought a war every year of their existence, more or less. Certainly since the American Civil War. I think he's talking about an example would be Mexico, where they stole more or less Texas from them, and then they kind of got the rest of it just by a third or fourth of the money that they first offered. But because of the greater force, they can do these things.
And what was the Munich Pact?
Well, that was the problem was Czechoslovakia and the minorities there were beginning to feel the same as what they would in Poland later. So Hitler threatened to invade if martial law wasn't called off, and at the last minute they decided rather than invade to get in touch with Britain and hold this meeting in Munich, where they came to an agreement. And as you said, people called it appeasement when it came back waving the piece of paper saying there'll be peace in our time. And there would have been peace in their time, only, you know, Poland came up and it was kind of a trap for Germany. They knew the longer it went on and the more minorities were being killed that Germany had to invade.
So they didn't break the Munich Pact at all. They avoided that. They avoided that by getting Britain involved and we get the peace in our time speech. And finally he says, there you are, unrestricted warfare in the whole Pacific Ocean where America really doesn't belong. And when we make a protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, which belonged to Germany for 1,000 years, it is considered aggression. Good point there. What's America doing in the Pacific Ocean? And, you know, exactly. This, you know, Germany was supposed to be hell-bent on conquering all these other lands, but all they were trying to do was bring back the countries that belonged to them originally and to secure Germany from invasion by Britain and the Allies through France and through these other countries. And when they occupied these other countries, the whole point of the occupation was that at the end of the war, those countries would be handed back to the rightful governments. That was the whole point.
Yeah, but the problem was these governments were not recognised by Roosevelt. He kind of froze all their assets. This goes back to the Masonic Christian thing. And Roosevelt, I've proved many times in documentaries, is the lengths that he was willing to go to get into the war. I mean, at one point he was sending American ships into war zones, and then to even further up the ante, he armed them ships to go into war zones and was practically egging the Germans to attack them, where Hitler gave specific orders not to attack. And even took German ships and the sailors prisoners.
Well, the next character that we've got on here is one that we've talked about quite a lot recently, Alfred Rosenberg, head of the Reich Ministry for the Occupied Eastern Territories. And remember that that video we debunked about Alfred Rosenberg? It was saying that he was responsible for ideology. He wasn't. He was the head of the Reich Ministry for the Occupied Eastern Territories. And he's got some interesting things to say. He says, crimes against Christianity. Did you ever pay any attention to the Russian crimes against Christianity? The Russians have the nerve to sit in judgment with 30 million lives on their conscience. Talk about persecution of the church. They are the world's greatest experts. They killed priests by the thousands in their revolution. The persecution of the church is a big question that goes back hundreds of years, and there are several sides to the question. The Lord only knows how much blood has been spilled by and because of the church. I don't blame the Russians at all for trying to break the stranglehold of this clerical monster. I have always been anti-Catholic. I mean, there's lots to get into there. I mean, pointing out it was the Russians that were really persecuting the church. And I think it also comes out quite clearly that it's the clericalism that he's against. He's against the organization of the church. He doesn't say he's against Christianity there. It's all talk about the church. He says, every American trembles before the power of the press. Poor Hearst, just because he published a few articles of mine and had his picture taken with me, his whole newspaper syndicate was almost threatened with bankruptcy, with boycotts and all. How similar is that to today? If any newspaper or mainstream media dares to interview a civic nationalist and actually print what they say and not attack them, they will be boycotted, attacked. I mean, look at Fox TV, just for having, forgotten his name, the guy from Fox TV that's on there that recently said that white nationalism is a hoax. And you know, you've got all these adverts that are pulling out and saying that they're not going to show their adverts on Fox TV. complaints yeah. about the Daily Mail featuring Richard Spencer and not attacking him. You know, all that sort of thing. And yeah. it's exactly what Rosenberg is pointing out was happening back then.
Yeah, the American press. Same tactics, aren't
they? Yeah. He says, of course they do not want to discuss the Versailles Treaty. That treaty explains how the whole war came about. Even the Americans refused to sign that thing because it was so evil. Wilson had drawn up his 14 points so carefully, and when the time came to make the peace treaty, the French laid their secret treaties with Poland and all the rest on the table and said that was what they were fighting for, and the 14 points were thrown into the waste paper basket. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So originally the Versailles yep. Treaty was something else, and it got changed, and the Americans didn't want to sign it. I didn't know the Americans didn't, you know, refuse to sign it.
I didn't know that myself.
Yeah, and that probably bears more investigation, what those 14 points were.
I know Wilson was well thought of because people thought that 14 points were admirable, but obviously they never got put into the treaty.
He says, history also considers the murder of 3,000 Chinese in the Opium War and the degradation of some 3 million Chinese by the British through their opium traffic. And how about the 300,000 exterminated by an atomic bomb in Japan and the air attacks on our cities? That is all mass murder too. Pointing out the hypocrisy there again.
Well, you can't say he's lying.
And he finishes talking about the Inquisition. He says, the Inquisition was a disgraceful chapter in Catholic Church history. Yes, and that went on for 5 centuries. It was not a momentary outburst of emotion. And I don't know quite what he was referring to there. I guess he was just saying that, you know, Germany was fighting a defensive war and fighting to defend itself against these Jews, and that only went on for a few years, whereas the Inquisition went on for 5 centuries. But, of course, I would have a different view on that Inquisition. I think it was a necessary thing. Yeah, it was necessary because you had these crypto
Jews
pretending to be Christians.
Required desperate measures.
Yeah, and subverting Christianity from within.
Yeah,
and they had to find out who was a genuine Christian and who was just one of these conversos. Next one, Arthur Seyss Inquart, the Chancellor of Austria, in 1938, before the annexation of Austria, they executed him. I don't know why they executed this guy. I mean, he was the Chancellor of Austria. Germany had the Anschluss. The Austrian people voted for it, and they executed him. And yep. he do you know much about him?
Not a lot, no. I mean, we do know, obviously, when the Austria did join Germany, then, you know, that was a major chunk of the whole Roman Empire. And I don't think they take too kindly to anybody to do with the Roman Empire.
Yeah, but I don't know, understand why they went for him. His quote, he said, anti-Semitism has been strong in Poland for several centuries. There is a religious slogan of the Middle Ages, save the faith and destroy the Jews. Interesting. They all held up, didn't
maybe
they?
Maybe it was revenge for the Rothschilds incident when Rothschild was thrown in prison for a year.
Well, they all held up, didn't they? They all kept, you know, to their views. They didn't back down. Yeah. The next one was definitely just a Rothschild revenge thing. Julius Streicher, who published The Stürmer, and he was executed simply for publishing a magazine. That was all he did. He published a magazine which made jokes about Jews, exposed Jews, I mean, similar to the Daily Stormer today, and they executed the guy simply for publishing a magazine. Nothing to do with the war. In his defence, Streicher described himself as the fate-ordained apostle of anti-Semitism. He described with dramatic emphasis how he met and was inspired by Hitler and spoke of the halo around Hitler's head, which Streicher actually saw. Interesting. He said, this trial is a triumph of world Jewry. They are crucifying me now, I can tell. 3 of the judges are Jews. I couldn't kill my wife and myself when we were in the Tyrol at the end of the war. I decided I would have to bear my cross. obviously referring there to Goebbels.
Yeah.
Seeing the concentration camp films, he said, "These are the last days." Again, interesting quote. He said, "After all, the Talmud itself told the Jews to preserve their racial purity. Theodor Herzl, the Zionist leader, even said that wherever there are Jews, there is anti-Semitism. The Jews are making a mistake. If they make a martyr out of me, you will see. I didn't create the problem. It existed for hundreds of years. I saw how the Jews were pushing themselves into all spheres of German life, and I said that they should be pushed out. After all, if you read the Talmud, you will see that the Gentiles should take measures to protect themselves against the Jews." He's not saying anything that's untrue there, is he? I mean, these are
facts. Well, he's not saying anything that's been said before with the Protestant restoration.
And he said the solution of the Jewish problem must be a state solution, because people with the same blood are drawn together and you cannot go against the laws of nature. Again, he's saying, you know, that's nationalism, ethno-nationalism. The nation is made up of the extended family and you can't have other people in there. They can't actually be a part of the nation.
And that is the crux of the problem, because that's truly what the National Socialists believe, but it's opposite to what the liberal and the communist believe. So that argument won't stand up with them, because they think all races should be mixed anyway.
Yeah, well, it's like they're arguing against the actual definition of the word. I mean, nation comes from the word natal. It means birth. It means people with a shared birth mother. It doesn't mean people that share the same ideology, which is what they'll try and say it is today. The word nation comes from.
Plus, Israel abide by them rules anyway.
No, it's only Israel that does, isn't it? It's allowed to. He says, "You can frequently tell a Jew by the eyes, but even if you cannot tell by these physical features, their behavior always gives them away. A German is so open in his manner, like a child, but a Jew is always two-faced. The prosecution at this trial is made up almost entirely of Jews." So you've got the so-called victims sitting in the judge's seat.
Yeah.
As well as it going totally against all precedents of law. Well, we got some final words here just before the execution from some of these characters, and we'll just get into them before we finish. Ribbentrop, he said, "God protect Germany. My last wish is that German unity should remain and that an understanding between East and West will come about and peace for the world." Hardly the epitome of evil, is he, saying that?
Or pagan.
Stryker said, "Heil Hitler." As he mounted the steps to the scaffold, he said, "And now it goes to God." Then, as the black hood was about to be placed on his head, he said, "I am with God." Interesting. Interesting.
He also took about 20 minutes to die, you know. Which is why they brought in the English hangman, because the Americans were hopeless at it.
Right. Horrible. Horrible that they kept making these mistakes with them. He would hope that, you know, maybe they were actually saved from any pain. Maybe that's what he meant by saying, "I am with God." He didn't feel any pain. Keitel said, "I call on the Almighty. May he have mercy on the German people and show them tenderness. More than 2 million German soldiers have died for their fatherland and preceded me. I follow my own sons. All for Germany." And we've got Jodl. He said, "I salute you, my Germany." And finally, the Austrian guy, Seiss Inquart, he says, "I hope this execution is the last act in the tragedy of the Second World War and that its lessons will be learned so that peace and understanding will exist between the peoples. I believe in Germany."
Which, of course, isn't true.
Well, it wasn't the last act in the tragedy, was it? It's still going on. It is still continuing to this day with the anti-Nazification and the lies about the Holocaust that have to be drummed into every child's head.
The white race.
Yeah, yeah, and the continued encouragement of the genocide of whites, it is still continuing. Is the thing, anybody that wants to know why the world is the way that it is, they have to go back to the Second World War. That's where it all originated. That's where
what stands out in these moments where there is no denial. You know, they're saying what they mean. It's, they know it's the last words, and there's never ever any mention of, you know, may Thor guide us or whatever. It's always, you know, God protect Germany, etc. And goes to even show even more that this National Socialist leadership were Christian.
It's all Christian, and they never defamed Hitler either. They refused to believe the lies about the Holocaust, and they refused to turn their back on their leader. Quite an amazing tale of courage, really. I mean, really, really interesting quotes there. But that finishes today's episode, Dennis. So thank you very much for coming on. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truth Without Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.